This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The beginning of the parasha deals with a subject which I've never gone into before, and it's very dominant in the parasha, and there's very little said and written about it. Most of what is written in Kabbalah, and we have a little bit of it in the Medroshim. It's the concept of the flags. After counting up the Bnei Yisrael, the various tribes are counted separately. Each tribe is tallied, and we finally get a total number. We're then told at the beginning of the second chapter of Bamidbar, Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe ve Aharon le'mor, and God spoke to Moshe and Aaron, saying, Ish al digloi be'oiso es levesa ve'son, yachanu b'nei Yisroel. Each man will camp, each man of the children of Israel will camp alongside his flag, by the sign of his family emblem, mineged, opposite, soviv le'oil moed, around the oil moed, around the Mishkan, yachanu, that's where they shall camp. What really happens is that the 12 tribes are divided into 4 subcategories, each category headed by one of the tribes. So what you've got is 12 tribes, 4 subcategories forming Klal Yisrael, each subcategory consisting of 3 tribes. The Mishkan was placed in the middle. On 3 sides of the Mishkan, the Levim used to camp around the Mishkan on 3 sides. That's on the east, north, and south of the Mishkan, the Levim used to camp. North, south, and west, Moshe and Aaron used to camp on the east side, so that formed a block around the Mishkan. That block was about 16 square miles, a little bit less than 16 square miles. That's without the rest of Klal Yisrael. Then started Klal Yisrael, and they were in 4 blocks. There was a block east in front of Moshe and Aaron that consisted of one group of 3 tribes. There was a block south, a block north, and a block west. And the second chapter of the parsha deals with the divisions of the blocks. So we have 2 aspects really to understand. 3. Number 1, the groupings. Why these particular tribes were grouped together. Number 2, the orders in which they are grouped. Not just why they are grouped together, but why certain tribes come after various others. They don't go by order of chronology as they normally are recorded. In terms of this grouping, they have a different order of priority altogether. And thirdly, and possibly most important of all, the concept of the flag altogether. What is a degel? Why is there all this fuss about the flag? By the way, the area, the total area covered by the camp was about 150 square miles in the Midbar when they used to camp. I don't know how big is the, does anybody know how big the greater area of Johannesburg is? I don't think it's anywhere near that. I think it's about 50 square miles. It was a huge area that they covered. Oh, really? It's as big as that? Okay, then it wasn't much bigger than Joburg, but the population was like Joburg, including Soweto. And nobody could see into anybody else's house. And nobody lived on top of anybody else. But when Bilam took a look at that, if you were going to say that Johannesburg is very small, I would have said, can you imagine how big this was? Now you tell me it was very cramped in there because Johannesburg has got half the population and more than that size. Then it becomes even more wonderful. It was such a cramped situation. Bilam has a look at them and he says, Matovu Alecha, what impresses him is the privacy. Everybody's left alone, everybody gets on with their own little thing, everybody is left to run their lives themselves without interference and without peeping and without looking and prying into what everybody else is doing. That's also a very wonderful thing. So that's how the camps were set aside, and chapter 2 goes into a little bit of detail. The background to all this is in the Midrash, and that's where we have to understand, where does all this thing start? Firstly, the Midrash refers to God fulfilling a long, long craving of the Bnei Yisrael to have a flag. Finally, God gives them, this is the time, this is a great moment for the Jewish people. Finally, a taiva of theirs, not just a desire, a taiva, a craving of theirs has been fulfilled. The Midrash tells us, finally, B'shor Shomar HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Moshe, when God said to Moshe, we'll do this Midrash in detail in a little bit later, Asei Otam Degalim, make them into flags, K'moshe Nis'obu, as they've always desired and craved for to be divided into their flags. They've always wanted a flag. So somehow this flag business goes terribly deep. It's something that they really wanted and really felt that they needed. When it's interesting altogether to note that the Jewish people have never had a flag. Even after this time when flags were eventually given to them, there was never a flag for the whole people of Israel. Until 1948 there was no such thing. It's a brand new invention. It has no tradition behind it, the flag, blue and white flag with a blue mug of David inside, which everybody pays such homage to, it's like a Sefer Torah. The flag goes up, everybody stands and sings, Atikva, and it's all wonderful, and people's hearts melt, and their eyes start dripping with tears. It's all very wonderful, because it does mean a lot to us, that flag, but it only means a lot to us in the last 30 years of our history. It has no meaning whatever prior to 1948. The Jewish people as a people never ever had a flag. Here we see the beginnings, though, of a flag. Let's see in what way did they have a flag. Obviously, it's implied by the Midrash that the Jewish people had been nagging God for the flag for a long time. Because one of the things that the Midrash says is that all the nations of the world have a flag. Let's see if I can quickly find the actual words of the Midrash. All the people of the world had a flag. The Ein Hashem Oyev Elo Diglo Shel Yaakov. And the only flag that God really likes is the flag of Yaakov. And that's a little bit of a shtef, because Yaakov doesn't have a flag. And he never had one. And yet that's what the Midrash says. Don't worry, Jewish people. Yours is the only flag I like. That yours is the only flag that I really feel attached to. But they don't have one. And that in itself is the important thing to understand. That somehow Yaakov represents a flag to us and fulfills the same purpose as a flag fulfills. What purpose does a flag fulfill? On a very superficial level, it's identification. That other people can identify you as belonging to a particular organization, belonging to a particular country, that that's where you belong. But there's more than that. The word flag is used various times in Tanakh. One of them, it's used in Tehillim, and something that we say every day, in the 20th chapter of Tehillim. In the Lamnatach Mizmor LeDavid, which we say at the end of the davening, Naranuno Bishuasecho, we will take joy, we will express joy in your salvation, Uveshem Elokeinu Nidgol, from Degel. And by the name of God, we will flag ourselves, we will raise banners, whatever that means. Rashi says, Uveshmo Nidgol Nitasef Benaseh Chayil, we will gather and make an army. So a flag is a banner under which a whole lot of different people can gather and move forward fighting for a common ideal. And a flag is a very irrational thing when you think of the wars that have been fought over flags, and the diplomatic messages backwards and forwards that are flashed all over the world throughout history until today, about the treatment of flags and how the flag is treated. The flag is emotionally and quite irrationally terribly, terribly important to millions and millions and millions of people all over the world. It represents something terribly deep to them, and we have to try and understand what it is, and what it is that the Am Yisrael strove for in order to achieve a flag, and why they were never given a flag as a people, but they were given flags as individual tribes. A flag, really the concept is expressed in the pasuk itself. Uveshem Elokeinu Nidgol. We will gather ourselves under the banner of the name of God. Nobody likes to fight in the war. And nobody likes to go to the army. And it's something that has to be done all over the world. And at the moment people feel a little bit bitter about it in South Africa. And they don't realize how bitter people feel about it. Even in Israel, where you're fighting for something which is yours, nobody enjoys it very much. Nobody goes to it with some great idealism. You have to. But mainly what the people are fighting for is to stay alive. They're fighting for survival. And if one is in the army in this country, one's also fighting for survival. It doesn't make terribly much difference. And we begin to get a bit bitter about it and how we're going to raise children here in 2 years in the army and all the rest of it. We forget that only a few years ago, everybody in the United States used to go into the army, and not to Southwest Africa or to Bloemfontein. They used to go to Vietnam for a year. And that we forget about. In those days, everything was okay. All of a sudden, so things are a little bit tighter here, so everybody wants to run away. Where are they going to run to? America, because there you don't have to go into the army. And at the turn of a slight event, one can find oneself going into the army there too. One can't run away from the army, unfortunately. One has to go through it. It's something that every country needs, and every human being living in a country has to go in for. This is nothing one can do, but we don't like it. It's no fun. How do they make people give their lives for a country? To go into an army, one of the things they do is they make you feel anonymous. You yourself are unimportant. It's the state. And that's the only way that army life can become tolerable. That you feel that somewhere in the whole makeup of things, where wheels are turning within wheels, this is all very important. And not only are you fighting for the state, but you are the state. There has to be total identification. And that's why in the armies in days gone by, I don't know how they do it now, they used to actually march forward with their flags. The flag is the first thing that used to go. To feel if we win, it's our flag that is won. It's not just me that's won. I'm unimportant in all this. I'm fighting for something much bigger. And it's not indirect benefit that my country gets from it. My victory is my country's victory. If I'm killed, my flag goes down with me. If I'm wounded, my flag is wounded with me. And if I win, it's my flag that has the victory. And so the human being, the soldier, feels part of something much greater. And not indirectly connected to something much greater, but wrapped up in something much greater. He's totally identified with the greater cause. And that's what Am Yisrael wanted. They wanted a flag. They wanted to feel that they're working for something worthwhile. They wanted to feel that they're identifying with something big. Look what Mesiras Nefesh is required as a Jew. To be a Jew right through your life, more Mesiras Nefesh is required than to be a man in the army. A man in the army, after all, okay, you go through some difficult periods, but not as difficult as it is just to be a Jew on a day-to-day basis. In the army, at least you're part of something big, and your flag is there, and your regiment, and it's all for the great thing, and the state president comes and says a few words every now and again, and you feel very important, and you're fighting for something worthwhile. So it should be. What does the Jew feel? Who assures him every now and again that he's carrying a banner? That's what a man wants to feel when he's Moser Nefesh, when he gives of his life, of his time, of his energy, of his family life, of his business life. He wants to feel that he's carrying a banner. He wants to feel that he's giving to something more important than all those things he's sacrificing. I'm sacrificing financially, all right. I'm sacrificing emotionally, I'm sacrificing physically, materially, family-wise, socially. That's all alright if what I'm doing it for is greater than all those things. But if I'm sacrificing for something smaller than those things, a person feels existentially dead and very perturbed and very disturbed. That's one of the problems that many people go through during their lifetime, looking back and realizing what they have sacrificed. And they ask themselves, for what? For a business. Or a profession. Unless one is satisfied that what one is sacrificing for is greater than what one is sacrificing, one's in for an existential shock sometime in one's life. And so the Jew wants to feel throughout that what he's living for, what he's sacrificing for, what he's fighting for, is a banner, something big. It's not that he's a little man working indirectly for some God sitting somewhere. He wants to feel that he carries God with him. And the Midrash says that explaining that pasuk from Tehillim, which I just quoted you, "V'shem Elokeinu nidgol," we will go with a banner of God. What does that mean? "Shekova Hakadosh Baruch Hu Shmoi Bishmenu V'asa Oisanu Degol." That God fixed His name in our names. Firstly, He did it literally. Yisrael, the word Yisrael, contains God's name. The Jew contains God's name. God's name. And secondly, of course, philosophically and emotionally, He's done it. The Jew contains God. We don't need a flag. You only need a flag if you are contained by your country. Then you want to feel important. You want to feel that you're doing something. But if you contain your country, so to say, what do you need a flag for? You are the flag. And that's what God says when He says to Yaakov, all the countries have flags. My favorite flag is Yaakov, the flag of Yaakov. That's my favorite flag. Because that's not a separate flag. Yaakov himself is the flag. And when a Jew fights, it's God who's fighting. And when a Jew is Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, when a Jew does something and it turns out to be a Kiddush Hashem, he does something which costs him a little bit of effort or a little bit of money or a little bit of time, whatever it is. But people look at him and they say, ah, that's a Jew, that's amazing, that's fantastic. That's not indirectly that he has caused the Kiddush Hashem to take place. He contains the Ribbono Shel Olam with him. When he wins a battle, it's the Ribbono Shel Olam who's won. When he loses a battle, it's the Ribbono Shel Olam who's lost. When he makes progress, it's God who's made progress. When he retrogresses, it's God who's retrogressed. Because every Jew contains a bit of God inside him and takes that bit of God around with him wherever he goes. And so with every act we do and everything we say, the Jew cracks a nasty joke. The Jew cracks a dirty joke. Or a slightly off-color joke. That's the Ribbono Shel Olam who cracked that joke. It's like taking the flag and sticking it in the mud and trampling over it. That's what it is, because we carry the flag with us. We are the flag. And if we talk a little bit of Lashon Hara, we've got the flag with us when we're doing it. It's not just us. And contrary-wise, when we do a mitzvah, when we make our kiddush, or we sit down and we learn a little bit, or we listen to a shir, it's not just us. Those are victories for the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's taking God with us as we walk forward. Every step we take forward into new territory, we're taking the banner of the Ribbono Shel Olam with us, step after step. And so says God to Israel, you don't need a flag. You are my flag. Wherever you go, I am there with you. It's not as if you represent me. You are me. You contain a bit of me, every one of you. What do you need a flag for? And somehow it appears that still the Jewish people weren't altogether satisfied with it. They still wanted the feeling of a flag. The need to label is so deep. I don't know what it is or why it is. I don't know why people can't relate. They can relate to abstract concepts, but somehow they can't relate to abstract phenomena within human beings, within other human beings. They can relate to the infinite. The human being is quite capable of understanding the infinite, and that's an incredible achievement. The human being can, to an extent, understand the infinite. He can manipulate with the concept of infinity in mathematics and in physics. He can understand the infinite in religion and in philosophy. But when it comes to other people, he must have a label. Who are you? Where do you come from? What do you do? When he asks who are you, he doesn't really mean who are you. He's not terribly interested in who you are. What he's interested in is who do you belong to? What's your flag? Let me see your badge. Like the poor Africans in Zimbabwe before the thing was finally settled, they used to carry two passports. The one was the Nakoma Party passbook and the other one was the Mugabe Party passbook. And when they used to be asked for a pass, if they knew who the questioner, who the interrogator was from, they used to take out the one he wanted. But all too often they didn't know, and it was just a chance, but they felt they had a better chance with both, and they would do an eeny, weeny, miny, moe and take one out, and if it was the right one, it was good. They want to know who you belong to, that's all. They're not interested in anything more than that. And we're the same. Show us the card, or you want a us, or you want a them. And you can't be both. There's some very deep need, and we'll understand a little bit more of that by the time we're finished. But what one has to understand is that even that need is to an extent explained and justified in the Sedra. It mustn't be misused and it mustn't be distorted. We're told in the Midrash, "B'shor sheniglo HaKadosh Baruch Hu al HaSinai," when God revealed Himself on the mountain of Sinai, Yordu imoy kaf beiz revoves shel melachim. 220,000 angels came down with God. A lot of angels, 220,000. Vohoyu kulo masuyim degolim degolim. And they were all sub-classified into flags. Each one had a flag and a badge. They were in uniform. And there were different uniforms. And most people have been in the army, if they see 220,000 angels in uniform, they'll think they're having a nightmare. And they run away. But not Klal Yisrael. They all saw this. Can you imagine what a level they were on? They all saw these 22,000 angels. Kivan Shero Oison Yisrael. Once the Jewish people saw these angels, Shem Asiyim, the Golim, that they were all in their uniforms with their badges and their flags. Hitchilu Misavin Lidgolim. The Taiva started again. They want flags. They want a uniform. It's unbelievable. Amru alavai kach anu nasim degolim kemesim. They said, if only we also could have uniforms like that. Very funny. Maybe it's something like children that look at soldiers and they think it's very glorious. I don't know what it is. But although it's so to say been explained to them that of all the flags, God loves the flag of Yaakov most, when they see at Har Sinai 220,000 angels, all dressed up in their uniform with their flags, the Taiva starts again. They want. They got a Yetzirah for flags. What can you do? Different people have different Taivas and different Yetzirahs. Klal Yisrael's big Taiva was for flags. That's what they want, the flag. Must have sounded like the grannies in Shul on Simchas Torah. The flag for my children, for my grandchildren. Flags, that's what they wanted, flags. And the Ribbono Shel Olam tells them later on, you have such a taiva for flags, I swear to you, I'll fulfill your desires and you'll get your flags. So God approves, God understands that they need it. What flags do they get? Each tribe gets a flag? And each group of tribes, three together to form a group, they also get a flag. What's it all about now? What the Ribbono Shel Olam says here? Well, let's first understand what they thought, what the Jewish people thought. Okay, they said. We understand now that as a Jewish people, we can't have a flag. By the way, I want to explain to you also why they couldn't have a flag. Why Yaakov can't have a real flag. When God says that Yaakov is his favorite flag, what does he mean? What does Yaakov stand for? Yaakov was the Bechir HaOvos. He was the ultimate of the three forefathers. And his ultimate was in that his middah, his characteristic, what Yaakov represented more than anybody else, was Emes. Truth. And you'll know, you'll remember from previous shiurim that Chos Moshe HaKadosh Baruch Hu Emes. God's stamp, God's seal is also Emes. So where it says that God united His name with our Shekhova HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shmoi Bishmeinu, that God fixed His name to our name, we have the same flag. God's seal is Emes, and our flag is Emes, truth. But Emes you can't put into uniform. The moment you define Emes in strict terms, as a flag would require, it can no longer be Emes. Emes needs the flexibility to be vibrant. Truth needs the flexibility to grow, to develop, to evolve, to adapt, to change. It's a terribly immature attitude to consider the truth must be something that stays exactly the same always. The basis stays the same always. The principle stays the same always. But the application is continuously changing. The application is never the same in two different circumstances. So the principles of Emes obviously will always remain the same. The application will change. And so while the principles of Torah remain the same, the principles of Torah will never change. Halacha, the application of the principles to life, is a continually evolving process. Every day requires new adaptations and so on. To put that onto a flag would be a denigration of the whole concept of Emes. You can't have truth on a flag. Truth is something you live. Truth is something you are. Truth is something you do. By the way you operate, you'll be a flag, says the Ribbono Shel Olam. By how you live, by what you do, by the way people see you operating, that will be my flag. Not that you go carrying around saying, we stand for truth, we stand for truth. It doesn't mean anything. If you stand for truth, as a friend of mine once used to say, if black is beautiful, you wouldn't have to tell us. It would be the same here. If you would have to go around saying, we stand for truth, we stand for truth, you can know that you're probably a liar. A truthful person doesn't have to gloat about being truthful. It's obvious, it's clear on his face that he's a truthful person. I was having a discussion with a businessman the other day, and in 5 minutes I counted 16 times. He says, would I lie to you? 16 times in 5 minutes. But when they saw that the angels could have a flag, that they couldn't understand. Why can the angels have a flag and we can't? And they realized then that there's another aspect to a flag. On the one hand, there's the South African flag, which represents South Africa as a united country to the rest of the world. But then there are other flags, the Transvaal and the Free State and the Natal and the Cape. And within the army, there are different categories, and each unit has its flag, and some are more important than other, and different levels within each unit have different flags and different numbers of stripes and dots and all sorts of fancy things. Every army has their own language of flags and signals, which mean all sorts of different things in terms of status. And they look very impressive, and people who know how to interpret them know how to give honor to the right people and how not to give honor to the right people, but it's very important. So there's an internal flag system as well. How to recognize where the other guy is holding. Now this is important to a society, and yet one has to be terribly careful. The importance of it is, I'll give you a Rashi on this week's Sedra. When we're told how the camps were situated, I told you that Moshe and Aaron were immediately on the east side of the Mishkan, and in front of them was the group led by Yehuda. Says Rashi, Moshe the Aaron of Olav, there was Moshe and Aaron and their sons, was smuchin lohem, and near them, Degel Machane Yehuda, was the camp of Yehuda. Vachonim Olav, Yisachar and Zvulun, and next to Yehuda, on either side of Yehuda, was Yisachar and Zvulun, but they were all in front of the east side of the Mishkan. Between the Mishkan and them was Aaron and Moshe. Says Rashi, Tov la tzadik, tov lishcheinu. We see from here that it's good for the tzadik, and it's good for his neighbors as well. Lefi shehoyu shecheinov shel Moshe, sheyoethek b'Torah, because Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zvulun were the neighbors of Moshe who used to study Torah. Nasu gedolim b'Torah, so they too became great in Torah. So it was necessary to know who's who in order to know who to associate with. Now we discussed at the earlier shir the concept of social pressure. And social pressure is something one has to face up to. It exists. We're social beings, and whether we like to admit it or we don't, we're terribly, terribly influenced by social pressure. The only choice we have in the matter is to choose which society is going to exert pressure on us. A human being doesn't have much choice in whether he's going to be affected by the society in which he lives or not. How much he's going to be affected, that he might have a bit of a choice. Some people are more affected, some people are less affected, but everybody is affected by the society in which they live. And our only choice is, what society is going to exert pressure on me? In what circles am I going to move? The people around me, what are they going to consider important? Because willy-nilly, what they consider important, I'm going to show them I can do. Because there's no way a man can operate in a society without any self-pride. And if he's operating in a society that values motor cars and he has none, that hurts. And he's going to get a motor car. And if he operates in a society that values learning and he has none, that hurts. And if he operates in a society that values external mitzvahs, just looking very frum, and he doesn't look frum, he'll start looking frum because that hurts. And so one has to be very particular in choosing the area in which one's going to operate. That means the area in which one's going to live. That means the schools to which one's going to send one's children. That means the friends one's going to associate with. And where does one develop one's friends? Where one studies, where one learns, where one has one's extramural activities. These are the things which are important to examine carefully. Because after years of marriage, it's already too late. And people come with all sorts of problems, and when you trace the problem back, where did it start? What was it? It was social pressure from outside. And likewise, when you look at very ordinary people who've become outstanding, after years they work on themselves, they've become really outstanding, and they were ordinary people to start with. And you say to yourself, what did it? How did that happen? Social pressure has a lot to do with it. They were clever enough to choose the right place in which to operate, the right place to live, the right place to govern, the right place to study, the right place to learn, the right place to meet people. And that in turn had an effect on them. Says Rashi, Tov la tzaddik, tov l'shcheina. It's good to choose a neighbor who's a tzaddik, who's busy learning Torah, because that will rub off on you as well. When you say to your neighbor's wife, come, would you like to go out to the movies? She says, sorry, my husband's busy learning, can't make it. What do you feel like? So next time you're a little bit more careful before you say such things. If that's something that you enjoy, if that's something that you feel you would like to attain, you want to fit into what the society considers valuable. And if the society considers that valuable, you adapt. And that's the skill that has to be exercised in the choice of society. Likewise, a tzaddik must realize also that in being a tzaddik, he's affecting the world. You know, people think that to be a tzaddik, you have to go running around all over the world, doing all such of things, beating up the Jews for Jesus and all sorts of things like that. That's what you have to do to be a tzaddik. It's not really right. And they say if a tzaddik just sits quietly and he learns, oh, so what's he doing for the world? What's he achieving? He's achieving a tremendous amount. Because the more such people there are that are quietly minding their own businesses, but living according to a certain system of values, and hopefully establishing a society that lives by that system of values, they're creating a whole new social pressure which will influence thousands of people more than anybody can influence by running out into the streets and trying to convert the masses. That's not how the Jewish people have ever converted the masses. That was the argument of Avraham with Lot. Lot went to Sodom. Avraham parked outside Sodom. Lot went to live in Sodom. Avraham said, my house will have four doors to it. There's no excuse for not coming in. But you come in. I'm not going out. The place to be influenced is in my home. Come and see the way I live. Come and live with me. And that's the way I'm prepared to influence people. Not by running around selling Yiddishkeit, bartering it, offering it on the streets at the stalls. That's not the way that the Jewish people have operated in spreading their Yiddishkeit. We operate by creating societies, and those societies in turn exert tremendous social pressure in an area that exceeds one's wildest expectations. Tov la tzaddik v'tov l'shcheina. If a man is quietly sitting minding his own business, there's nothing more that he can be doing for his society than that. Because his immediate neighbor will benefit from that, and so it will go down the road, the whole neighborhood, the whole area, the whole country ultimately will benefit from that. On the other hand, says Rashi, if you look at who was dwelling together or near Kahat, Kahat was one of the three families of the Levim who were camping on the south side. And next to them, just one moment, let's get the Rashi. Mishpachat Kahat Yachanu, Taimana, they were camping on the south. Usmuchin Laim, says Rashi, and near Kahat was Degel Reuven, the three groups headed by Reuven. Achonim Taimana, also on the south. Oila Rasha, Voyel Ishchenai. You remember the story with Korach, he came from Kahat. And he had 250 supporters. Where did those 250 supporters come from? From his neighbor, from Reuven. That's the first place one looks for support. Those are the first areas one tries to influence. So Rashi warns us already in the Sedra. Choose your neighbors carefully. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says the same. Choose your friends carefully. Choose your areas of operation carefully. Just watch it. Be careful. Now to do that, it's very useful to have badges and uniforms. It's very difficult to get to know everybody sufficiently well and sufficiently quickly to be able to keep away from those you have to keep away and get to know those that you have to get to know. Because until you get to know them, you don't know them. And so you get to know the wrong ones and you ignore the right ones. So it helps to have a badge. But now one has to be careful. Because one can have a superficial badge. One can have a badge which, okay, you belong to the group, so you're given a badge. Now you can fool the world. You're part of it. You're accepted. So unless one would know, for example, of a particular organization that they are very, very choosy, that under no circumstances does anybody get a badge to that situation, to that organization, until they've reached a certain level, the badges would be meaningless. This really is what Am Yisrael wanted, and that's why they got so excited when they saw the angels. They felt, right, we as a people, as a nation, can't carry a badge because our badge is Emes. And Emes can't be reduced to a flag. It would be a diminishment of Emeskite if we reduced it to a flag. So we understand that. But we want to feel some more identification. We don't want to feel that we're working within a nebulous, huge crowd for a concept called Emeskite and God. And there are no flags and there are no teams and there's no group, nothing. It's part of the dynamics of the Jewish people that they were divided up right at the very beginning into the 12 tribes, each with its own identity. It's very important for human beings to operate in a pyramid sort of basis. First is the individual. And he must feel himself as an individual and know himself as an individual and take pride in himself as an individual. And that's why every individual was counted. He's counted not in the sense of having numbers like they count with senses, but he was counted in the sense of being an important part of Klal Yisrael as an individual on his own. Then he's got to feel part of a family, a beis av. Who is immediate family? One has to know something about one's family. This book, The Roots, which made such a fuss in the States and throughout the world, it suddenly awakened in people the fact that, you know, no matter who your family is, you can take pride in them. Even if you come from some slave in Nigeria, it doesn't make any difference. It's yours. That's where you come from. Know your roots. Know where you grew up from. You weren't just made when you were born. The day of your birth was not the beginning of your history. That's the last little detail in your history. Your history started thousands of years ago. It's necessary to know and understand one's parents. Who are one's parents? What are their unique points? What are their outstanding points? What is my father's outstanding point? What is my mother's outstanding point? What is that union form which created me, the individual? And one has to go back further. Where do my parents come from? With travel as it is today, it's becoming a little bit more difficult because one starts getting quite confused. One's mother came from here, and one's father came from there, and one's grandfather from somewhere else, and one's grandmother from someone else, and one's lost. But it used to be, and in this country very largely it is, that the parents came from very much the same place. If you analyze with your own parents, you'll find that they probably grew up within not many hundreds of miles from one another, if that. And their parents and parents, you'll find it's a long line that comes from a long line, and one gets to know one's family as far back as one can. And one's cousins and one's aunts and one's uncles, one has to feel there is a family. One's part of a family too. And then one has to see that family, in those days at least, as part of a tribe. Part of a group of people who have something in common more than one has in common with a man in the street. You see, on the one hand, one has to feel one's own individuality. But at the same time, one has to feel identified with others. And to feel individual and part of Klal Yisrael at the same time is very difficult, if not impossible, unless one goes through the pyramid channel. I feel myself identified as an individual and part of my immediate family. That's not so difficult to understand. Once I'm able to balance those two off together and integrate them, I feel part of a wider family and then part of a tribe. The tribe stands for certain things. I want to show you how special the things that the tribe stood for is. You will have noticed in the Sedra that when the Jewish people were counted, they were counted from the age of 20, excepting for the Levium. The Levium were counted from the age of 1 month. And Rashi asks, why only from 1 month? Why weren't they counted from birth? And Rashi explains why they should be counted from birth. He says, because this Shevet, this tribe, Mibetin Lemudin, they're taught from the womb already, they know and they understand what they've got to do, they understand their function, they taught their function, the Levium, this is. So the Levium somehow, what the Levium have to do, is something which is given to them by birth. And I explained in the Ladies' Shiur this morning, that there are two kinds of yichuses that a person can have. There's the yichus with which you're born, which is very important yichus. Gives one a head start and it can enhance everything else that one does. There's no way you can take away from it somebody who grows up in a very special family. What can you say that he's the same as somebody who grew up on the street? He's not.
In some ways he's better, maybe in some ways he's not as good. But he has something which the other kid doesn't have. You know, there are the pros and the cons of royalty, but you can't say that a guy like Prince Charles, who looked like a very ordinary fellow once upon a time, all of a sudden he's become quite kingly. You can't take away from a fellow who from the day he was born is brought up in a palace, with his mother a queen, seeing prime ministers walk in and out of his house all day. What's the conversation he hears at the table? Matters of state. Protocol he's lived with, he's brawned with it. It's in his bones, protocol. To be dignified, what a king is. He's born with it. Min ha-betan, from the womb. You can't take that away. You can't pretend it's nothing and say we'll get rid of them and we'll make another one. It's not the same. There's yichus with which one's born, which is very important yichus. And one can't belittle it at all. And that's what the Levi'im had. The Levi'im were born with a special tahara, a special purity, which enabled them to fulfill the functions of Levi'im. What about the Bnei Yisrael, the other tribes? They were only counted from the age of 20. That implies, although Rashi doesn't say it, that the other tribes took 20 years to cultivate that unique thing which made them a member of that tribe. That's outstandingly fascinating. Whereas Levim were members of the tribe from birth, the other tribes were really only members of the tribe after 20 years. Whereas Levim were Lemudim mibetin, in the womb they learned how to be Levim. Whatever you need to be a Levi, I don't know what it is, but whatever you need, you've got when you're born. Not so the other tribes. The other tribes, something you need, which takes 20 years to cultivate. What is it that you need? And here we'll go through the Medrash that deals with the tribes and what they had and why they're grouped in their particular grouping. Says the Medrash, Bara HaKadosh Baruch Hu Dalet Ruches Leilom. God created four directions to the world. Mizrach, Ma'arev, Tzof, and the Dorim. East, West, North, South. Now, it's difficult. You've got to understand that this Medrash is partly Kabbalistic. And that part of it I can't explain to you. A, because even if I could, I wouldn't. And B, because I can't, because I don't understand it. But there's enough that one can understand from the Medrash without going into the Kabbalah. So that when it talks about four directions, it doesn't just mean geographical directions. It means four, I don't know, much more than that, directions in which the world can go, kind of. Mizrach is the east. Misham ha'or yotzei l'olam. That's where light comes to the earth. That's where the sun rises. That's where hope comes from. Somehow they saw the east as the beginning of everything. Everything started in the east. Bearing in mind also that the Garden of Eden was just east of Israel, that the whole cradle of civilization there was just east of Israel. Just east of Israel was a very important part in that time. Ma'arov, on the west, Oitzoros Sheleg v'Oitzoros Borod v'Koyr v'Choyim Yotzin Leilom. That affects the drastic changes in temperatures. You've got snow and hail and cold and heat. That all comes from the west side. Don't forget the sea is on the west of Israel. Maybe that has something to do with it. Dorim, from the south, where we live, Talalei Brocha v'Gishmei Brocha Yotzin Leilom. Dew of Brocha and rain of Brocha, all sorts of material wealth, comes from the south. Tzofo, in the north, Misham HaChoshech Yotzin Leilom. That's where it's black, it's dark, up in the north. And then it goes on to say various other things, and it comes to our subject, and it says, Uchenegdan, and opposite, or representing those four directions, Sider HaKadosh Baruch Hu HaDegolim LeMoshe, God ordered the flags for Moshe. Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said, Moshe, Mizrach, on the east, Shemimenu Or Yotzei LeOlam, from which the sun comes to the world, the light comes to the world, Yiye Kenegdo Yehuda, Shehu Baal Melucha. The group headed by Yehuda should go on the east side because his kingdom, he stands for royalty, leadership. The Olav Shevet Yisachar Shehu Baal Torah, and next to Yehuda on the one side should be Yisachar, who are the learners of Torah, the scholars.
The Olav Zvulun Shu Bar Ashirus. On the other side of Yehuda, you need Zvulun, who were the wealthy businessmen.
So on our east side, which is the side where everything starts, you've got Melucha, you've got leadership. What constitutes leadership? Yehuda, who has a natural leadership ability. But Yehuda needs to be supported by two things, because in order to be a leader, you need two values very clearly. You need independence, that's really all you need. But to be independent, you need two values. A leader who is not independent is not a leader. It enables growth. The next thing you need, says the Medrash, once you've got your leadership organized, and your leadership is independent, and it has Torah, it has intellectual independence, and it has financial independence, the next thing you've got to organize is a bit of softness. Leadership is hard, leadership is brutal. Right behind the leadership, you need a bit of softness. And you've got Reuven there. Reuven is the Baal Teshuva. He did wrong, and he fixed his wrong. He was always the one who pleaded when Yosef was being judged to be killed by his brothers. It was Reuven who pleaded with them to let him live. Reuven is the one with the more human midas, who's able to follow behind the leaders. And what do you need on the two sides of Reuven? You need Gad, who we're told is Gad Godud Yegudenu. Gad has strength, brutal strength. And on the other side, he has Shimon. Shimon is the one who did wrong. And in the blessings of Yaakov, he was virtually cursed, you remember. Shimon was the one that together with Levi went and killed the city of Shechem. And Yaakov was very upset about the way they did it. And the impetuousness of it, and the extremism of it, and the fanaticism of it. And he said, you will have to be scattered among the people, because if you'll ever form a community of your own, you'll be dangerous. So where does Shimon go? Shimon goes together with Gad, strength on the one hand, and Reuven on the other hand. You've got Reuven, the Baal Teshuva. A Baal Teshuva has to have something to do Teshuva about. So he's got Shimon, who did the Aveiro, and he's got Gad, who has the strength. So the Baal Teshuva has to be very careful. That which enables a person to initially say, I was wrong, is in a sense a measure of strength, and in a sense it's a measure of weakness. Man does an Aveiro. Does something wrong and he says, Chotati, I've done wrong. It's only a measure of strength if he's going to fix it. But if he's going to say, I did wrong, and tomorrow he's going to do wrong again, and he'll say, I did wrong, terrible. And the next day he'll do wrong again. And then he'll start feeling guilty. And then he'll develop guilt complexes, and then he'll go and see psychologists. Then his original saying, Chotati, I sinned, is a weakness, that's not a strength. When is Chotati a strength? Is when you say Chotati and I'll never do it again. And you can stick by it. That's Tshuva. So for Tshuva you need the sin that Shimon. You need the softness which is Reuven. The softness to be able to say I did it, okay, it was wrong. And the hardness of a God to make sure that you never do it again. And right behind Torah, that's what you need. You need this balancing. Torah is going to live, it's going to operate. Torah is going to lead. Yehuda with Yisachar and Zvulun, they're going to be out in the business world. They're going to be out in the political world. They're going to be out leading the nation. They're going to do wrong. Ki ein tzaddik v'shigat etzoyv baratz v'lo yechta. There's no tzaddik who does good in the world and doesn't sin. You can do no good in the world and not sin. But to do good, to be active in the world and not sin, that's not possible. And Yehuda, as the leaders, are going to go out sinning. Inevitably, they're going to reach situations where they have to decide and do things quickly, and they might do Averos. The next thing you need right behind them is Reuven, the ability to do Tshuva, the ability to repair that which is done wrong. What do you need after Tshuva, says the Medrash? There you need, on the, we now come to the west side. Ma'arav on the west, Otzoros Sheleg v'Otzoros Borod v'Kor v'Chom. You've got these terrible temperature extremes. What do you need? You've got a leader who's going out. Now, if the leader was just going, he would become brutal. So together with leadership, you need Tshuva. So that the leader doesn't become completely hardened and brutal, you need Tshuva, the ability to look at something you've done and say it was wrong and fix it. A leader can lose his nerve also. He goes out and he does something and he works out it's wrong and he can lose total confidence. And it happens a few more times, he's finished. The next thing you need after that is Chenegdam Ephraim Uvinyonim Umenoshe
You've got
Ephraim, Binyamin, and Menashe who are praised as having staying power. They have courage, not in terms of God's courage, of going out to fight, but they've got staying power, they've got stability. It can rain, it can hail, it can snow, the sun can come out again, it's hot, and they just stand, they don't move. That's the camp that stands on the west side. So after your leadership, after your tshuva, you need your gevura, you need your power, your staying power, your perseverance. That's what that tribe had. They had perseverance. Now there's one more thing you need. You need a snake. You remember the shiur about Dan a few weeks ago. You need a politician. Yehuda with his uncompromising leadership ideals, followed by Reuven with the tshuva, and Ephraim, Binyamin, and Manasseh with their staying power, you still don't have someone who can fight the snakes. To fight the snake, you need a snake. We need somebody on that kind of level, and that's where Dan goes. Dan goes on the north. We remember the Medrash told us that the north was the dark area. You need some people come out and fight in the front. At the back of the camp was going the group of Dan. You remember, where does Amalek come from? The back. That's where the darkness comes from. They always attack in the dark. Like guerrilla warfare. Guerrilla warfare are guerrillas. They are people who fight without flags, without uniforms. You can't see them. You don't know who they are. Warfare in the old times, an army used to come out and declare war, and you saw your enemy, and you knew your enemy, and you did battle with your enemy. It was a gentleman's war. But today, you don't know who you're fighting. It can be somebody who's living in your own house that you're fighting, and you don't even know it. That's the snake. That's the worst of the whole lot. That's something which has to be uprooted. But you can't fight guerrilla warfare by being a gentleman. That's what the English learned when they fought the Boers, and what the Americans didn't learn when they fought the Vietnamese, and what hopefully the South Africans know already. And the Israelis certainly know. If you want to fight a guerrilla, you've got to behave like a guerrilla too. You can't do it the gentlemanly way. So we need a Dan. Uchenegdon shevet Dan. Lama shehu hichshich ba'ilam. He's always dark in the world. You remember we discussed Dan, the Avodah Zorah he got involved in, and the things he did. Dan, Yaakov, his father, was so worried about Dan that he still said after blessing Dan with that particular strength to be politically astute. You remember Yaakov still said, Lishuoscho kivisi Hashem. Ribbono shel Olam, I pray for the salvation of Dan. Because that ability to be a politically skillful can be the downfall of a human being. So what does he need next to him? He needs two things. Says the Medrash, the Olav Shevet Asher Meir Alachveshech. Asher represents life. He was able to explain things to Dan. He was able to somehow show a light in a place where there's darkness. It's a special skill altogether to introduce brightness where there's dullness, to introduce simcha where there's sadness, to introduce light where there's dark. Only some people have that personality. That was a skill of Asher. And he has to go together with Dan. Dan, you're working in the dark, that's fine. But when you come home, there must be light on. Don't come home into the dark as well. Politicians, we have our snakes. But those snakes must be directed outwards, not inwards. And it's a terrible danger that a snake doesn't know how to stop being a snake sometimes. And he starts off working outwards, and when he comes home, he carries on acting like a snake. What you have to do when there's a snake in the house is turn on the lights. He doesn't like light. He doesn't like to be seen. Snakey guy operates in the dark. He doesn't want to be exposed. Have Asher there. As soon as he comes home, turn on the lights. He can't behave like a snake here. And you need brocha. And the other one is Naftali. Shehu molei brochas kedei lefarnes. He's full of blessings so as to provide the living. I think there are two aspects to the brochas of Naftali. Firstly, a politician neglects his own business. He becomes so involved in his calculations and his thoughts and his planning and his strategy that he stops making money. And it's very often politicians find to their own shock that after having been in politics for a few years, they've got no profession left and they've got no business left. It's a choice one has to make. And don't become a politician unless you have financial support. Don't try and be a politician and make your own money as well. It can't be done. If you're going to be a politician, then your whole head goes into politics. And you can't look after yourself. You need the brocha of Naftali to create the living. And also I think the brocha is not only parnosa, but as we just said, that when Yaakov gave Dan the blessing of politics, he he said to him, Mishivosko kivisi Hashem, a politician needs bracha, because a politician without bracha is going to be a snake. He has to be very careful. He needs tremendous blessing to remain a mensch, although he's a politician. And here you have the whole of Klal Yisrael. You have a united nation. You have the leadership, made up of three parts, made up of Malchus, royalty, Torah, and financial independence. Right behind them, because after Yehuda started walking, Reuven came behind them. You have Reuven with the softness, the flexibility, the human qualities and characteristics, the integrity, the ability to say chotasi, with the strength of a God supporting that chotasi, so that I'm not just confessing to something I won't repair, but that when I've said chotasi, it will never happen again, because I have God in me too. And then behind that, we have the people with perseverance to be able to see it through. Now, there are two kinds of strengths you need for tshuva. You need that first strength to say chotasi, which I said can sometimes be weakness as well. Then you need the strength of God to give a smash, I'll never do it again. And to be sure that at that moment you'll never do it again. And that's why the Rambam says, in fact, says, how can we get up every Yom Kippur and say, Chatan, Shashamna, Bagadna, Gazalna, and next year we do the same, and the next year we do the same. What's all this business? Surely Tshuva has at least got to require that we don't go and repeat it, and we know we're going to repeat it. Says the Rambam, as long as you can feel at that moment that you're not going to repeat it, as long as you're able to raise yourself to such a level of recognition and understanding that at that moment you can't conceive of yourself doing it, even though later on you happen to do it, it can happen. That's the power of God. To immediately say it, I won't do it. You know, sometimes one has to jump into the swimming pool. There are certain things one can do step by step, and some things one needs to jump. You can't get born step by step, and you can't get bar mitzvah step by step, and you can't get married step by step, and you can't die step by step. Those are things which happen in a moment. And to take certain major plunges in life, you need the power of God to jump. But that's only the beginning. Then you need the Menashe and Ephraim and Binyamin, the staying power to stay in that water even though it's cold. To jump into marriage and jump out again 6 months later when it doesn't look as if it's working, that's God, all very nice. You're a brave boy, you got married. But no staying power. To say, from tomorrow I'm going to start doing ABCD, that's wonderful. And if you do it tomorrow, that's God. To be able to keep up with it day after day after day. For that you need the other quality, the staying power. In the heat, in the cold, in the rain, in the snow, it makes no difference. We go on and on and on. That's the power that comes after Reuven. Comes this group of tribes which has the staying power. And at the back, to deal with the snakes, we've got Dan, the politicians. And on each side of Dan, we have light from Asher, and we have blessing from Naphtali. Because Dan on his own is dangerous. Dan has to have support. One understands that God says, yes, you can have your flags, but it's not going to be an easy club to get into. I'm not going to give you a flag for Klal Yisrael. I'm not going to give you a flag that represents the whole Jewish people, because you're born into that. And you're not going to get a flag into which you're born. Levi doesn't have a flag. If you want a flag, it's a flag you're going to have to deserve. I'll give you medals, not flags. That's what he's really saying. If you want a medal, you'll work for it. It takes 20 years. And if you make it, you'll have a medal. God says, yes, you can recognize people by flags. It's not wrong to want to classify people into their strengths. Because one can classify. And one can create teams that way. One can put a Yehuda together with a Yisachar and with a Zvulun. One can put a Reuven together with a Shimon and with a Gad. One can put a Dan together with an Naphtali and an Asher. One can put together the right teams if you understand the flags, if you understand what each one stands for. But it's got to be things they've achieved, not things that they've just signed the membership for and now they're part of it. That's why Rashi says, for Levi, they started counting them from 1 month old. But for the other tribes, you had to be 20 before you were counted. What's a bit of a pity is to look how things are today. Today, who walks in front? Dan! The politicians are in front. With no Asher and with no Naphtali next to them. Out there alone. The people who we put at the back to deal with the snakes, today are out up in front. And who comes after them? The stayers, the civil service. They stick around one election after another, the solid, stable people, one government in, one government out. No, it's no different. They're there all the time. The people who really run the country are not the politicians. The line just behind the politicians. Without them, the place would collapse. The good old civil servants who sit there day in and day out, and they do their work, and they sign their documents, and they file their things, and they work like good clocks, and they keep the place going. They're second. And third is Reuven, all the nice people. The teachers, and the doctors, and the professors, and the shopkeepers, the normal people. The voters. They're next. And where's Yehuda? Where's the real leadership? Certainly doesn't make his appearance anywhere. One doesn't see him anywhere. Keeps quite a low profile. The one who's supposed to be out, Mizrach, right up in the front leading. He's scared. He's off somewhere else. And Torah, where's Yisachar? In the gutters somewhere. In the gutters. They're quite irrelevant. Not playing any major part in influencing events. What the whole idea of who influences events? Should be Yehuda, the leaders, with the Torah scholars and the businessmen. That should be the president's council. Yehuda, the Torah scholars and the businessmen. Those are the people who should be influencing world events. And those are the people who are right way behind, exactly opposite to the way it's supposed to be. And one begins to understand why we're in such a mess. We don't understand our degolim. We don't understand our own strengths, number one. It's terribly important. Before one starts this whole thing is to understand one's own strengths. And once one understands one's own strengths, one has to understand other people's strengths. And then one has to start making teams. One has to see that one fits in the right place. And Aaron Moshe had a very interesting discussion with God. This is the last midrash I'll bring you. Make them into flags the way they've always wanted. Hitchil Moshe Meitzah, God, Moshe said, oh no, please, not that. He says, God, what's the matter? Omar, he said, Achshu v'asidu ha-machlokes li'inosen ben ha-shvotim. Can you imagine the faribos and the machlokes? Im ani omer l'shifte shil Yehuda sh'yishle b'mizrach. Imagine I'll tell Yehuda to go to the east. V'u omer yeh shoyla b'dorim. He says, no, I want to go to the south. V'chein Reuven, v'chein Ephraim, v'chein chol shevet b'shevet. Ma'ani yoyser, what will I do? How am I going to get everybody to cooperate? Until now, you leave them alone without flags, without badges, everybody finds their own place, and I don't care much about it. But if we're going to start giving people places and status, and although it was a round table, they dwelt around the Aron, we're very particular about protocol and about orders of preference. Even at a round table, there's a head of the table. Mizrach is the head. Yehuda goes first. Says, Moshe, I must go now, seat everybody. You know, like the husband and wife before the dinner party. You seat everybody. No, you seat them. That's how it goes. The people need to be seated. Says God. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Moshe, says God, Mayach Patlecha, what are you getting upset about? Take it easy. Etzrichim Lecha, they don't need you. You don't have to tell them where to sit. You just have to give them their badges, give them the flags. And don't tell them where to sit. They'll find their own places. May Atzman hay may kirin dirosom. They know themselves where to sit. El ladayti ki yesh biyodan mi Yaakov avim hech lishvus bediglayim. They have it handed down from Yaakov. When Yaakov ordered them to carry his coffin, he ordered them to carry them in a particular way. Yehuda, Shim, Yisachar, and Zvulun to carry in the east side, and Reuven together with Shimon and Gad to carry on the south side, and so on right around his coffin. He organized them that way, says they know. That's an incredible limit. Because what we're told is, how does a person get to know this? It's part of a culture. To know one's own self-worth is something that has to come from your parents. As parents, one of the most important objectives is to instill into our children a feeling of self-worth. They've got to know where they come from. They've got to know what their strengths are. They've got to know where they operate and with whom they operate best. That comes down from Yaakov. That means that God is agreeing with Moshe, so to say. God is saying, Moshe, you're right. If Yaakov wouldn't have handed it down throughout the generations, you would have had an impossible job. you would never have got consensus. But this is something so ingrained, they've had it for centuries, they know how to operate. And this is something which we had until the Second World War. Until the Second World War, we had yeshivas, where each yeshiva had its own tradition. You had the Mira yeshiva, which had an old tradition. You had the Telza yeshiva, which had an old tradition. You had Slabotka, which had an old tradition. You had Radin, the Chofetz Chaim's yeshiva, which had an old tradition. And each yeshiva was able not only to flourish, but also to interrelate productively with other yeshivas. If you're satisfied with your own self-worth, you know what you are, and you know where you stand, you don't feel threatened by others. And boys, your yeshivas themselves used to send the boy from this yeshiva to that yeshiva. The same as Gad understood he's got to sit next to Shimon. Shimon wasn't a nice guy all the time, but that's just too bad. Gad is going to fulfill his purpose best by sitting next to Shimon. He's going to serve the flag of Emeskite best by sitting next to Shimon. That's what he'll do, he'll sit there. And he has it down from his father, and from his grandfather, and from his great-grandfather. That's the way they used to sit. They used to sit with Shimon. That's how it used to be with the yeshivas. The Rosh Yeshiva would figure, it's best for this boy's progress that I send him from my yeshiva to another yeshiva. And likewise, they used to cross-pollinate all the time. But wherever you went, as you walked into the door, you were struck with the uniqueness of that particular approach. And you understood that you either came, and you adopted that approach, and you adjusted to that approach, and you learned from it, or you left. But that was stood for a certain approach. There was individuality within the approach, but only within the approach, not without the approach. And when you had to have enough of that, you would move on to another approach. And not only were there yeshivas like that, but there were families like that. There was the Briska family. There were families in the Soloveitchik family, long trains of Gedolim who had a particular style to them. If you went to learn by one of the Briskas, you knew what you were getting, and you knew where it came from. And wherever you went, there was a long line, because you knew who your Rebbe was, you knew who his Rebbe was, and who his Rebbe was, and it went back for generations, and there was a particular style that you were going to get. And not only was that within Lithuania, but throughout Yiddishkeit, there was Lithuania that had its own style. There was Poland, which had its own style. There was Hungary, which had its own style. There was Romania, which had its own style. There was Czechoslovakia, which had its own style. There was Germany, which had its own style. And going back to the time of the Rishonim, the Meiri never refers to a Rishon by name. He talks about the wise people from France, and the ones from Africa, from Egypt, and the ones from Spain. There were schools. Each school followed a certain philosophy, and you could see how it worked. There were Hasidim, and there were Misnagdim. And there were different kinds of Hasidim and different kinds of Misnagdim. And sometimes they fought with each other, and sometimes they laughed with each other. And they always cooperated with each other. Always. And today, we don't have Hasidim, and we don't have Misnagdim. We don't have Lithuania, and we don't have Hungary. We don't have Poland, and we don't have Germany. We don't have Spain, and we don't have Egypt. We don't have Telz, and we don't have Slabotka. It's all part of this whole uniformity package. Everything's the same. Today, what is the difference between Oxford and Cambridge? What is the difference between Yale and Harvard? Uniform, that's all. Essentially, there's no difference anymore. There used to be cultural differences. And in styles of learning and in Yiddishkeit, there used to be cultural differences. When you've got differences, you can make a blend. When you've got no differences, you've only got a mishmash. And today we've got a mishmash, that's what we've got. That's part of the reason that things aren't Mesuda. That we don't have Yehuda up front, supported by Reuven, with Binyamin behind him, and Dan at the back. Part of the reason we don't have that is because we don't have a Yehuda, and we don't have a Reuven, and we don't have a Gad, we don't have anybody. We just have one big mixture. Everybody's got a bit of everything. That that is so is bad enough. The only thing is, let's not make an ideal of it. Let's not create a new religion that celebrates the mishmash. New religion, not Hasidim, not Misnagdim, not Lithuanian, not Polish, just a general mishmash. That would be a new religion which would be too abhorrent for speech. Let's at least try as far as we can to go back a little bit. We can't get back to the tribes maybe, but to understand our families, to understand our backgrounds, to try and learn Torah the way our grandparents were taught Torah and our great-grandparents were taught Torah, to try and practice Torah and live Torah the way they used to. I told the ladies in the shiur this morning that a certain Rosh Hashiva was out visiting a very wealthy man with one of the members of the Beis HaMedrash. And this wealthy man was a man who, I'm told, had lots of servants. And this Rosh Hashiva at first was quite overwhelmed. I mean, he's been in South Africa many times and he knows what servants are. But this kind of palatial existence he'd never seen. And they went in and they started talking, and the servants wheeled in the tea. And the balabos, who's not from, and who is as distant from anything Torah that you can possibly imagine, not just distant, but anti in many ways, got up and he poured the tea himself. And Rosh Hashiva said, "That is a Lithuanian Jew. No matter how far he's away from Torah, no matter how far he's away from Yiddishkeit, a mensch he'll always remain. Something of this, that Lithuanian background he'll always have." That's the Rosh Hashiva perceiving the roots and the background of a human being and showing that cultures don't get lost. It's only the superficial trappings that can get lost. You can forget your Torah. You can lose the practice of Yiddishkeit. But you can't lose your culture. And what I'm saying to you and to everybody is, don't lose culture. Rediscover it. Understand it. Reaffirm it. Delve into it and get into the background of it. And see that the Yiddishkeit and the lifestyle that we adopt and that we practice today is not something that is newly created, and is not something that we've adopted from other people that we've watched. It is something which is intrinsically ours and ethnically ours. Something which is not just a puppet sort of imitation, but is something which is steeped in our culture and in our background. Something in which we're able to take pride, not only as an individuals, but also as members of our Beis HaMedrash, of our South African community, of our Litvisha background, and of the Klal Yisrael in general.